us where you're from and how you happen to have taken part in this Mississippi project this summer?
I'm from New York City. I'm a school teacher, and I've been teaching since 1930. And all along in our experience, it was not just civil rights in 1964, but it's been civil rights from 1930 and before. So this is nothing new. I have a son who is now 23, who's been involved in civil rights in the South for the last 2 years. He said to us before he went, "Do you object to my going?" And we say, "Why do you ask?" And he said, "If you do, then everything you have taught us through these years by your speech and your actions would be an absolute lie if you refused the permission to go now." Well, the time has come when my son drafted us to follow him. He followed us all along, and now we have come down here, my husband and myself, to teach in the Freedom School.
Would Mr. Sear like to say something?
No, like, hello, folks.
What can I?
Well, you all know the story about the henpecked husband who insisted that he was not henpecked, that on the contrary, he made the really important decisions in his family. It was true that his wife decided where they should go for summer vacation and what clothing they should wear and where the kids should go to college and how they should invest their money. But he made the important decisions, like what to do about the atomic bomb and how to decide the situation in Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera.
This is also this is William D. Jones on July the 2nd, also done at Des Moines College. He's here for the purpose of integrating this group that's going to Mississippi.
Yes, I have a habit of integrating everything that I find is little white. I integrated a faculty at Fillmore, Long Island. I'm the only Negro on the faculty. And I came here and find that I'm in a smaller minority. There were four of us when I came, and others have left, so I'm the only one here. So I think I'm the next group. Like you can call me a type of a perpetual integrator. I'm going to see to that. it's embarrassing to find that there's so many of you here and so few of us here. But you can understand when you realize.
No,
I looked around and observed that I was only Negro present, you know, in this group. It reminds me of a time when I joined the faculty, you know, 2 years ago at Belmore, Long Island, and I was the only Negro, still the only one there. I looked fine here, and I'm the only one. I've had several experiences in my life which I was the only one, say, in Texas when I finished dental school. I was the only Negro in my school, San Antonio, Texas. So I have quite a habit of breaking little white things.
Well, good. Lots of luck to you on this.
Thank you very much.
Ruth, you're one of the people at this orientation at Memphis. Would you please tell us your name, where you're from, and why you came here, and how you feel about it?
Hold it. Well, my name is Ruth Kearney, and I'm originally from Scotia, New York, which is a small town near Schenectady. However, I've been teaching school in the state of Washington for the past year, having graduated from college last June. The reason why I'm here is basically, I think, because I have become aware of an injustice which exists in our country today, and somehow I feel a responsibility to do what I can about this injustice. I could as easily have been born Negro. I could as easily have been born a poor white, yet I wasn't. Therefore, I have certain advantages which other people don't have.
A speech by Reverend Vincent Hardy of Atlanta, Georgia, that was delivered at Oxford, Ohio, the orientation there. The speech is so outstanding that I had to interrupt this man. I'm sorry.
The singing that's done in the movement, and that has been done in most movements like these, is a kind of singing that is somewhat similar to whistling as one walks through the graveyard. Because because it is obvious that, you know, when we sing we are not afraid, we are really saying we are afraid, and help us, whatever power we believe in, not to be afraid. And I think that there's a sense in which you have probably already, within the last 36 hours, learned as much about what you need to know about Mississippi as I can tell you now. I think that it would probably be helpful, considering the things that you must be thinking right now, if perhaps Chico could lead us in singing "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around." Because as you sing out the name, it sort of helps you to deal with the people that we really fear in many cases. I want to start out first by saying that those of us who have been talking about this project for 6 or 8 months have always talked about it with a good deal of apprehension. And a part of the apprehension has grown out of the fact that we didn't quite know what kind of kooks would be coming down to take part in this revolution. And that's not too strong a way to put it, as some people have talked about it. But from what I can see, I think that a great many persons who talked about this over the difficult winter and the spring that has just passed, and who have seen you here in Oxford, have had a great sense of encouragement by your presence. I see Victoria Gray nodding her head, and if she nods her head, you know it's pretty much okay. I want to say that I feel very much the same way, that I'm very much impressed with you and with the kind of seriousness and yet avoiding a somberness with which you take the assignment that's before you. And I personally, as one who shares this human condition with you, really want to tell you that I am deeply grateful for your participation in this experiment. And I am grateful not as a Negro saying to whites, I am grateful for what you're doing. But as I said, I am grateful because as a human being, you help me to know that there are still human beings who live for something else than being cool and dispassionate. And I want to say, before going into the body of the morning's concern, that if you are concerned about what or how you will do in the days and weeks ahead, I can, in a sense, testify to you that probably the most important thing that you will do will simply be being present. And I say this because I've found again and again, in a thousand ways, openings that have come to have meaningful involvement simply because I was present in Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia. So try not to be too anxious once you have determined to be present. This morning, as you have been told, I got my just desserts for being present. And you will too. I was all set to do a real boss job criticizing what somebody else has said. That teaches you, you see. Now I have to say it. And what I'm going to say is, as you can probably tell, not really prepared for this kind of situation. For what I want to do is to start out with a brief and sketchy job on the history of the Negro in America. happened to have with me for another kind of situation altogether, and which, as I share it with you, you will probably recognize it's for another kind of situation, but I thought that this would provide at least an adequate foundation from which we can take off. Then after talking about the history of the Negro in America, and of course the history of America's response to the Negro, I want to say something about what this means for the Negroes and whites of Mississippi at this moment in history. And then I want to say something about what this means for you who will be going to meet the Negroes and whites of Mississippi. At that point, I hope that I will have bothered you enough that you will be ready to open up into the discussion and questions and to be as honest as you possibly can in what you have to say and what you have to ask, because I take it that one of the hallmarks of the kind of society that we are trying to deal with and one of the hallmarks of the kind of society that we are trying to create is honesty in facing one another. Those of us who come out of the tradition of the New Testament would put it, speaking the truth in love. And I think that this is the kind of society that we seek to build, and obviously we can build it only as we practice it. Let me then start with the background. Ever since the first slaves were brought to the American colonies in 1619, the people of the new land have lived in the midst of a deep and frightening contradiction that goes to the heart of our society's life. Indeed, this dilemma is so basic to our existence as a nation that it is impossible to understand the significance of what goes on today in Mississippi and elsewhere without a serious consideration of slavery. For by the time that slavery was officially ended in the course of the Civil War, that institution had set an indelible mark upon American life. And all who wish to make believe that it doesn't really count are playing games. Its effect on our history is at least as deep as Puritanism in New England, the movement of the Western frontier, and the rise of the federal government. So just as no one can really understand America today without understanding Puritanism or the frontier life or the federal form of government, neither can we understand it without facing honestly the institution of slavery. It was not that the practice of selling and holding men as property was new to the world when it began here on a large scale. Actually, some forms of slavery had been in existence for thousands of years before the 17th century. However, that was the century in which it was destined to become one of the great money-producing industries of the time. Before the trade was officially ended in this country, it is estimated that anywhere from 50 million to 100 million African men, women, and children were forcibly taken from their homeland to be sold as slaves here. Of course, as soon as we mention the words men, women, and children, we begin to get some idea of the nature of the dilemma. We begin to see the contradiction, for the question must immediately be asked, how could rational, civilized human beings justify a practice that allowed them to hold millions of their fellow humans as mere property, often treating them like so many head of cattle? Here was the beginning of the contradiction, humans treating fellow humans as if they were less than human. Another aspect of the contradiction was this. From the time that the slaves were stolen from the villages, gathered on the west coast of Africa, and stuffed like livestock on board the ships, they were systematically robbed of their past. They were separated from family and tribe. They were penalized if they sang the songs of their homeland. They were beaten if they tried to communicate with each other in their native tongue. They were allowed no opportunity to practice the religion of their fathers. However, at the same time that they were being forced to give up their African heritage, they were being told that they could never be truly accepted as full-fledged citizens of the New World. Thus, they were caught in a cruel trap, men and women without a country, men and women behind a seemingly impenetrable wall. representation took place. These nation builders proudly proclaimed that all men were God's creatures and had been granted an equality that was only his to give, not to be earned, but his to give. So while their slaves worked in the fields, and while the free Negroes of the North were denied the right to vote, these men boldly announced that all men were entitled by birth to the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So the contradiction of words and deeds, of slaves in the midst of freedom mothers, was written into some of the basic documents of the Republic. The contradiction went even deeper, though. Many of the persons who were participating in this industry were members of Christian churches. A significant number of the owners and captains of the slave ships were New England Christians, and they faithfully contributed a part of their profits to the church. Indeed, at least one of the slave ships was named Jesus. Many of the slaveholders were also Christians, and sang sometimes daily of the love of Christ that filled their hearts with joy. Very often the slave auctioneers, who with the tap of a gavel sold mothers away from their children and brothers away from their sisters, very often they rested from their labor on Sunday, giving God thanks for the lovely family that surrounded them in their pews. Therefore, the institution of slavery helped to produce a split personality in the life of our nation and our churches, a wall in the heart of our land. It produced in Negroes a sense of deep distrust of white persons, which still remains. It led to unnumbered attempts at rebellion, beginning with those who leaped off the slave ships into the ocean, choosing death over slavery. Rebellions about which we never read in most of our history books, by the way. It produced a culture in which both Negroes and whites often lived two lives, one for whites and one for blacks. It led Negroes to live lives of destructive deception in order to exist. It led whites to a myth of superiority in order to justify their actions. Slavery made freedom for all a mockery, and justice was usually for whites only. A Supreme Court said that black slaves had no rights that a white man needed to respect. So as southern slaves and northern freedmen helped to build a nation, they continued to be its property, or second-rate citizens at best. The nation's practices were opposed to its declarations. Then, when it had to decide whether or not it would continue in this path, North and West were divided against South. However, the land was divided in deeper ways than simply section against section. It was divided against itself. Finally, in 1861, the inner conflict came to the surface most vividly in war, beginning at Fort Sumter, but unofficially on the good ship Jesus, 2.5 centuries before. It was near the end of this war that Abraham Lincoln said in his second inaugural address, "It may be that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came." Then he added, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." It is significant that a short time ago, Gloria Richardson of Cambridge, Maryland, quoted this statement, and I think that we need to be afraid. None of us can be sure, of course, whether Mr. Lincoln's interpretation was an accurate one. Only God knows that. However, it was clear before the war was over that the Civil War, like all other wars, had added great new reservoirs of bitterness and guilt to the life of the nation. Some 600,000 of the nation's finest young men, black and white, had been killed. Hundreds of thousands more had been seriously injured, sometimes by their own brothers and fathers. The South had been particularly visited with the terrible blight of marching, destroying on in armies, but the North had not been spared its own terrifying experiences. When it was done, slavery had ended, but the nation was no less against itself. It had lived with its contradiction for too long, and in spite of constitutional amendments that sought to offer former slaves all the rights of citizenship, a war had not convinced America that its slaves were now fully citizens, fully human, fully brothers. For a short, exciting period in the South, the freedmen were given a chance to participate in the political life of their community. In some places, they were elected to important public offices, including Congress. Even more significantly, they were able to work together with white persons in some places in the Deep South in an attempt to build a new kind of social and political community. However, this was all done under the generally watchful eye of federal power in the course of Reconstruction through occupation. When, in 1877, federal troops were finally pulled out of the South, there was a great reaction, and every attempt was made to push the former slave back into his place. He had been tainted by thoughts of equality and freedom and participation in government, and those who ruled the South were determined that the Negro would be purged of such thoughts forever, even if he had to be killed to purge him. Often he was. The South belonged to white men, they said, and they would run it and their Negroes with it, according to their wishes. When it became clear that there would be no significant opposition to this policy from the North, a systematic effort was begun to guarantee that two results of the Reconstruction would never be repeated. One, that Negroes would never participate in the government through voting or office holding, especially in places where they were in a majority. And two, it was sought to see that Negroes and poor white persons would never join themselves together to solve some of their mutual problems. Basically, the leaders of the white South were able to do a rather effective job of carrying through their objectives, largely because they received substantial, active, and passive assistance from the white society of the North. The federal Reconstruction had left the freed Negroes almost completely economically dependent upon their former masters and other white persons. If the slaves had been given some land or other means of gaining an independent living, much might have been different. But as it was, their economic lives almost always depended upon white persons. That was an effective weapon in itself. So when Negroes had their names erased from voter registration lists, in some places more than 50% of the former slaves had registered to vote during the Reconstruction occupation, when they had their names erased from the list, both physical and economic threats could be used to keep them from trying to get back on. Both were used extensively, and Negroes were effectively removed from political life in most southern communities by the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. Then, by an intensive campaign of racial antagonism, whites and Negroes were effectively separated. This period saw the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, originally a threat against whites who did not work hard enough at keeping Negroes in their place. One of the most effective aspects of this campaign, however, was the series of Jim Crow laws at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, which legalized the wall of separation between Negroes and whites in the South. This also succeeded well, and in 1896, it became a part of the constitutional law of the land. It was constitutional to separate men and women on the basis of race, as the Supreme Court said, and it said it. quarters of a century after emancipation, these walls were not effectively challenged, and we came to believe that men were meant to live with walls between them. The terms your people and my people became part of the general vocabulary, and I hear it now in the white community and the Negro community, rather than the white and Negro members of the community. We had accepted segregation as part of the American way of life, even though we claimed to be a great melting pot. Color evidently didn't melt. And even in places where segregation was not legally enforced, it was often enthusiastically practiced. Wherever it was practiced, it led, with few exceptions, to unequal justice, indeed to injustice. For segregation had grown out of the dilemma of our legal and political system, too. Segregation was partly the result of our making some people more equal under God than others. Therefore, it was not surprising that segregation almost always involved injustice. The Negro jobs, the Negro sections, the Negro schools, the Negro balconies, all were almost always inferior in number or quality or both. This was natural, for segregation at its deepest level expressed our conviction that the Negro himself was inferior. In its course, segregation also convinced many Negroes of this fact. How else could we justify our having kept him in slavery for 2.5 centuries? There was something more, though, for segregation, whether legally enforced or enforced by social custom, was unjust to white persons, too. For it kept them away from persons whom they might have wanted to meet, to know, to love. It kept them away from their fellow citizens, their fellow humans, their fellow Christians. Therefore, it kept them away from a part of themselves. It was unjust also in encouraging them to think of themselves as superior to other persons just because of the shape of their nose or the amount of melanin in their pigmentation. So segregation involved injustice to Negroes and to whites. Walls are always impartial in their injustice. Therefore, it was not surprising that when the Supreme Court declared against segregation in 1954, it declared that it was unconstitutional because it was unjust. With that declaration, a new age began in America, the age of racial revolution. In a sense, though it wasn't new, the world has been experiencing it for at least a generation. All over the globe, men and women, mostly darker-skinned ones, were rebelling against oppression, injustice, and the unjust rule of the white Western world. Africa became a symbol of this revolution, but it has been worldwide. In some parts of the world, communist forces have tried to control the revolution. In other places, the Western powers have made the same attempt. Neither has really succeeded, though, for the movement towards a life, freedom, and independence is too large to be captured by any one camp. While the Supreme Court decision of 1954 was the symbolic beginning of the age of revolution and ever-mounting protests in the United States, the rebellion against the wall of slavery and segregation had long been present. Ever since the first slaves leaped off the ships, ever since the first rebellions of Vesey and Turner, ever since the Underground Railroad, ever since the countless black suicides, ever since the Negro abolitionists like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, ever since the Civil War, ever since the beginning of the NAACP, ever since Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement, ever since the trade union movement, ever since the thousand events and movings of men, the racial revolution has been very much among us. Most often, we chose not to see it, for it made our self-contradiction too painfully clear. And we said, oh, the Negroes like it as it is. They like to be with each other. However, when the nation's highest tribunal condemned the unjust wall of segregation, we could no longer hide. It could no longer be hidden. Some men continued to try, though. In the South, they said quite clearly they would not obey. And the first White Citizens Council was organized less than 2 months after the decision. When Negro children appeared at formerly white schools that fall, they were refused admittance. In the North, men did not speak as loudly and frankly, and most thought that the decision didn't really apply to them. But if 1865 and said that desegregation must come with all deliberate speed. This evidence of determination on the part of the Supreme Court strengthened the resolve of those hundreds of thousands of persons who were convinced that the walls of segregation should come down. Now it was clearly stated that the Constitution was on their side. So a strange revolution developed, a revolution in which the Negroes in the South and increasingly in the North were committed to overthrowing the existing illegal, unjust system of segregation in favor of the constitutional system of desegregation and justice. So these revolutionaries worked to bring state, local, and community laws and practices in line with the national law. They sought to end the external contradictions between America's democratic ideals and its racial practices. They tried to end the international contradiction between America's self-proclaimed leadership of the, quote, free world and the deprivation of the right to vote experienced by millions of its own citizens. They tried it through the courts as the NAACP brought school desegregation cases in more than 40 communities immediately after the 1955 Supreme Court order. They tried it in the streets as thousands of Negroes walked to work in Montgomery, Alabama in 55 and 56, rather than ride on segregated buses. They tried it in 1957 as civil rights supporters tried against the filibuster to get a hesitant legislature to pass the laws necessary to support the decisions of the Supreme Court. In the North, the men discovered that they were not immune when in 1959 a group of Negro parents refused to send their children to their Harlem ghetto school, complaining of discriminatory educational policies. For those who had told themselves that the Negroes were satisfied with segregation, the revolution came as a shock. But there was more coming. In February 1960, a group of college students at one of the predominantly Negro schools in Greensboro, North Carolina, appeared in the Five and Dime store where they had shopped many times. Only this time was different. They sat down at the lunch counter, quietly, politely saying by their action, "We are tired of being relegated to the back of the society. We have come to be served. We have come to be human. What will you do?" They went to jail. But a new spirit of protest had soon spread to the Negro college campuses. And in 2 months, sit-ins had been introduced in 65, 7, and border cities. Before the end of the year, more than 200 cities were called upon to face the young men and women who were determined to break down in their lifetime the walls that had been constructed by centuries of injustice, apathy, guilt, and fear. 100 years had passed since the Emancipation Proclamation, and they were determined to be free. Of course, the college students and others knew that there was a price to be paid for the breaking down of walls. That had been discovered ever since the days of lynching. In this decade of revolution, it was discovered when the Negro children tried to obey the Supreme Court and attend formerly all-white schools. They were harassed, spit upon, and sometimes beaten. Their homes and schools were bombed. Again and again, it took the force of federal power through marshals or troops to lead them through the small breach in the wall. In Montgomery, they had discovered it soon after they stopped riding the buses, when the house of Martin Luther King Jr. was bombed, endangering the life of his family. Then, when the question, the all too common, inevitable question of retaliation was raised by an angry crowd of Negroes outside the house, King sought to set the theme for the entire revolution. He said, "We cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence. We must love our white brothers no matter what they do to us." Obviously, to many of you, this is going out of style. But I wonder if it is going out of truth. He told them to protest actively against the wall of segregation, but to let love for their brothers be the compelling force. For only such love could bring black and white together after the walls were down. As the revolution continued, the capacity for love was often strained as the bombings and resistance continued. Often local officials as high as governors and Congress or in the Supreme Court. It will come in the jails. Meanwhile, the course continued to mount, and men continued with fervent determination to hammer at the wall. In 1961, buses were burned, men beaten, and the jails of Jackson, Mississippi were filled with freedom riders as the local laws of segregation were pitted against the Supreme Court ruling. By the end of that year, there had been almost 700 jailings in Albany, Georgia, with 500 more coming the following summer, as that city became a symbol of the protest against America's inner war. Throughout the South, Negroes attempted to register and vote, and in many places met only further intimidation, resistance, and sometimes death. In the fall of 1962, death again accompanied the breaking of the walls, as two men were killed in the course of James Meredith's entry into his own state's university. The wall was high and hard, it seemed. In Birmingham, Alabama, police dogs and fire hoses defended the wall, but Negroes continued to assault it. Indeed, in that very spring of 1963, scores of communities knew the experience of men storming the walls of segregation. Sometimes the price was jail. Sometimes it was broken skulls. In Jackson, Mississippi, it was a man's life. Medgar Evers. For some persons, it grew harder to listen to Martin Luther King's call to love. It was easier to retaliate with bricks and curses and guns and hate. In Washington, D.C., 250,000 persons gathered from every part of the nation on a day in late August 1963. Black and white, Jew and Gentile, Protestant and Catholic, they marched to protest the war. They marched to plead for a new community without walls. Less than 3 weeks later, the wall was defended again with dynamite, and the death of four girls in the Birmingham church building and two boys outside. Meanwhile, Congress debated whether the wall should be assaulted with a civil rights bill. The wall was high and hard, and many lives had been lost against it, and more persons were growing bitter and impatient, not simply against the wall itself, but against the millions of Americans who, by their apathy and passive cooperation, allowed it to stand. So they challenged Martin Luther King, asking, why? Why? Why do we have to love? Why do we have to love, even after beatings and rejections and dying? Why? You will meet men and women in Mississippi who are asking that question. And I would like to fold this over now with three approaches to what you will meet in Mississippi. Something about the black men that you will meet who have come out of this history. Something about the white men that you will meet who have come out of this history. And something about how you may possibly respond to these men and women who shall not be known unless you know out of what they have come. There are black men who say, why in Mississippi? For there is a bitterness deep within them that must not be denied. It must not be encouraged, but it must not be denied. A bitterness against their white rulers. A bitterness against the white man. You hear it again and again. You've heard it here many times. The white man. There are dangers involved in calling people the white man, calling people the redneck, for these stereotypes are just as dangerous as the nigger and the colored man. But men and women live within these stereotypes as a result of their history. And whether you like it or not, you are the white man to many of them. And therefore, as you meet them, you shall meet them with their having many very mixed feelings about you. Make no bones about that, for they will meet you with gladness and with fear. They will meet you with hope and with distrust. Let me give you an example. The staff people who are in Mississippi and who have worked and who have gone through much of the fire and burden of the movement, many of them have not known the kind of college experiences that you have known. Therefore, when you come into the meetings, when you come with all of your allowed to believe that any white folk could possibly be qualified to be in charge. And so they will know deeply within themselves that you have the qualifications in many situations to be in charge, but they will not want you to be in charge, and they will not let you be in charge. This is a result of 3 centuries. You will meet a strange mixture of love and hate as a result of this kind of history. You will meet a situation like the one that James Baldwin so beautifully delineated in Another Country. Rufus James Baldwin, in the beginning of the story, remember, was making out with this white girl from Alabama. And if you remember the scene that took place on the balcony outside of the apartment, it tells, I think, a great deal of what is going to be involved in the breaking down of this wall. Because one of the responses to the war and to what has been going on for so long is a certain aggressiveness. And that aggressiveness often comes out in sexual aggressiveness. And some of you gals who are white have, I'm sure, already met it here, as a matter of fact, if you are honest. This is another reflection. It's not simply your beautiful face. It's a way, in a sense, of getting back at you because you are white. And just as Rufus entered into sexual intercourse with this girl from Alabama, both loving her and fighting her, both desiring her and wanting to set her apart, both seeking to hold her and to kill her, this, I think, you are going to find. You're going to find it, as I say, in a certain kind of sexual aggressiveness, both on the part of Negro fellows and Negro girls towards you. It grows out of the love-hate response, but it grows out of some other things. It grows out of that curiosity which is inevitable when people have lived on the opposite side of walls. And not only are they curious, but obviously you are curious too, so be aware of that fact. This kind of aggressiveness and this kind of really mad and mixed up relationship between white and Negro that you will meet will come also because people want to prove that they are in a new age. They want to prove that the South can no longer tell them who they will go out with and who they will lie down with. And because this is the way they think they will prove it, they will be out after you. And you're going to have to determine how you're going to meet this. They're going to do it in a sense to try to prove that you're really with the movement. Unfortunately, some people think that the only way that a white person can prove that they're with the movement is to go to bed with a Negro. You will have to deal with this, and you will have to deal with it quite honestly. It will, of course, come because of other things, sometimes simply the release of tension and the desire to forget all of the hell of Greenwood and Roeville and Neshoba County. But you will meet this. You will also meet black men and women who have been caught up in this identity crisis that the nation has brought upon us all for the last 300 years, who have been told in many ways that they are no longer Africans and they are neither Americans, and therefore they do not know who they are in many cases. And in an attempt to deal with this factor, they have come to a point which one can almost call a kind of black racism, in an attempt to say, yes, I am good because I am black. For a long time, the nation said, you are good because you are white and you are bad because you are black. Now there is a kind of racism involved that says, you are good because you are black and you are probably not so good if you are white. You must deal with this. You must confess to yourself how unnerving this is when you come to Mississippi to create a new integrated society, and these cats are talking about black supremacy, but you will meet this. You will also meet people who like to sing the song, I've been down so long that down don't bother me. You will meet people out some of you with Negroes to help recruit people for the freedom schools or for the community centers. And when you and the Negro walk into this Negro's house, again and again and again, this Negro will be looking at you and talking to you and saying, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, that's right, and paying no attention at all to the Negro who has walked in with you. And that Negro is going to be pretty angry with you as a result of that. And you must realize that this is the case. You'll be meeting, of course, Negroes whose spirit may not be point broken, but who are very much afraid. Who are afraid and who are seeking at any cost to stay on good terms with white people. And they'll stay on good terms with any white people they can find, you see. And this is going to be hard for you, and I'm going to say a little bit later on about, I mean, how I think it might be dealt with, but recognize that it's going to be there. But thank God you're going to meet some other Negroes too, some that you've already met here. You're going to meet some that have been freed and some that are in the process of being freed. You're going to meet some who have been freed in their old age and who are some of the great saints of this movement. You're going to be living in the house with some of them, as a matter of fact, who could not be having you in their house unless they were freed, unless they were somehow or had been able to even transcend their history. And you will be meeting these people who are determined to act out their freedom in every aspect of life, and you must stand beside them and walk beside them. For these, some of them have even been freed from the need to hate, which is one of the greatest freedoms of all. You will meet them. Some of them will have been freed from the need to deceive. Some of them will be freed from the need to hide. And some of them will have been freed to be able to associate and to be honest. Many of them have found this freedom out of their own deep sense of religious conviction. And whether you believe it or not, you had better take their conviction quite seriously. You know, I would say, you know, when you find this kind, hold them tightly. Or more likely, when they find you, hold them tightly, because they are pearls of great price. Let me say a bit about the whites that you will meet. It is impossible to imagine that this kind of history could have been lived by white persons without a certain kind of national mental illness being involved. Bob Moses calls it the plague. Perhaps that is as good as any term. From what I have seen among those who are white in the state of Mississippi, the best single word that could be used to characterize their condition at this moment especially is fear. I want you to really understand this, and I want to get you to understand it in 5 minutes, of course, but I hope that you will try. It's a fear approaching paranoia. And indeed, it probably is a kind of paranoia. Because for a long time, Mississippi has lived in a state that has encouraged paranoia from within and without. Everything threatens many of the white people of Mississippi. Everything that is new, everything that is strange, everything, anything from a Negro voting to a white girl in a hip-length shift dress, anything that is new threatens the white Mississippi. For everybody is against them, you see. The whole nation is against them. The United Nations is against them. The world is against them. And they are fighting a lonely, noble battle, as they understand. In many cases, this fear is the predominant feeling. And remember, I think, if you remember this fear, I think it will have something to do with how you approach people who are caught by fear even more than they are caught by hatred. This fear, this paranoia, is a result of their poverty. It's a result of their sense of inferiority. It's a result of their state's studied attempt to keep blacks and whites apart. It's a result of the controlled press that's there in Mississippi. You have to see it to believe it.
It's the result of the white pressure and terrorist groups that are there. And you know, when you're saying, I'm not afraid, I'm not going to let the Ku Klux Klan turn me around, or the White Citizens Council, to a large degree, the Klan and the Citizens Council isn't mostly worried about the Negroes of Mississippi, or even those of us who come to work with the Negroes of Mississippi. The Klan and the White Citizens Council are worried about the other white people of Mississippi. And these white people of Mississippi live under constant fear of these organizations. And many of them are convinced that they cannot stay in Mississippi unless they kowtow to everything that the Klan and the Council says and does. So remember this, and think of how you might be operating in Ohio or California if you felt that your economic and physical life depended upon going along with segregation. Therefore, I would say, you know, whether the door is closed or locked or both, remember that whether, whichever one it is or whatever combination it is, that it's closed and or locked for the usual reason that people close and lock things, and that is fear, deep, pervading fear. And this fear, of course, has a lot to do with the kind of Christianity that has been talked about in Mississippi, a kind of Christianity that does not deal with life in the society as it is. A kind of Christianity that cannot bring men into facing the new and the strange. Therefore, because of this fear, and because of their past, any time they see Negroes and whites together, they are going to be threatened, they are going to be frightened, and people who are threatened and frightened most often respond in violent ways, either inwardly or outwardly or both. And you're going to have to decide, you know, what to do about this. Because of their fear and because of what's been done in the state of Mississippi, and because of a great myth that's been passed through Mississippi about how eager Negro men are to get at white women, they are going to be deeply troubled each time they see a white woman in the company of Negro person, Negro men especially. And you have to realize this is not simply because they are foolish, but because they have been poisoned in many cases. Of course, you know that some people, you know, are poisoned also up in New York City and Chicago on the same issue, so don't be surprised about Mississippi. It's just that in Mississippi, they're less sophisticated in their responses to it. Because of this fear and because of this history, there is a tremendous sense of threat about Negroes achieving political power. Listen very closely to the statements that are made. These statements have been becoming clearer and clearer over the last couple of years, especially after a period of quietness. And Ellender and Stennis and a number of other people are saying, you know, quite honestly now, even in Congress, but my goodness, in counties where the Negroes are in 60 and 70% of the population, how can we let them get into political power? They are afraid. And of course, you know why they're afraid. They are afraid because they know what happened when whites were in control of the Negro minority. Therefore, they can't imagine that anything but hell could result when the Negro gets in control of the political situation. It is a tremendous and fearful thing to many white persons in Mississippi. And let me give you an example of the way that Mississippi simply does not conform to the usual Marxist interpretations of what goes on in our society. deal with this conviction of ours that the people of the world and the people of Mississippi are political animals first or economic animals first. I challenge this. I think that they are something else first before they are these, and that will have something to do with how we must deal with them. Two more things I want to say about the white people that you mean. One, of course, is that the part of this fear of Negroes achieving some kind of status is a fear simply among many persons that there is not enough wealth in Mississippi now for really both whites and Negroes to live on a good level of life. Now, the fact is that as Mississippi is presently situated, there isn't enough. And so, therefore, people, in a sense, have a justified fear. But therefore, rather than trying to find ways of building up the situation of the economy so that there can be enough for both to live on, instead the solution is to keep the Negro down or put him out so that we won't have to worry about him anymore. But the final thing that I would say about the whites that you will meet is that you will meet some white people in Mississippi, believe it or not, who have not been backed up against the wall, who have not allowed themselves to lose their humanity through fear. Some people will tell you there are no such white people in Mississippi. All I can say is I know that there are, and you had better look for them, because Mississippi will not change until there are white people who are working with Negroes to change it. How does one deal with this? I'm not sure. This is the last thing I'll say before we take a break. I think we have to recognize that we are dealing with a situation that is somewhat out of keeping with our American way of life at this point, because we have now, especially in our generation, we have now moved into the cool world in which men say there are no ideologies, there are no causes. Anybody who gets excited about anything is spooky. Anybody who thinks that there's a cause to live and die for must be nuts. And so we are going into Mississippi for a cause in the midst of a society that doesn't believe in causes except the saving of one's own skin. I think we'd better recognize that we're not going to be heroes and go not expecting this, even if we do wrap the gauze around our head and go out. I would suggest a few things that you must talk about some more as after the break. I would suggest that as you meet the black men who are filled with bitterness and who will be sitting in the same room with you and the staff in Ruralville or Greenville or Meridian, but as you meet them, accept this bitterness. First of all, accept it. Sense of assurance about your relationship with the Negro people that you work with, but you don't have to prove to them that you hate white people. Because we've got enough haters on the scene right now. We don't need 250 more to go down. In terms of this matter of, you know, the different backgrounds from which we've come and the difference between Radcliffe and Mississippi State, I would say, you know, just as a general policy, be somewhat hesitant at first to throw out too many ideas at once. In the first place, it will amaze you how much you can learn by that process, because there's a great deal to teach, and these cats who have been on the scene can do a great deal of teaching. But you know, not only must you be hesitant because there is something to learn, and not only must you be hesitant to throw out too many of the well-formed, prefabricated ideas too quickly because of the resentment that it causes, but remember that most of you are going to be there for 6 or 7 or 8 quick, hot weeks. And thing must never become your ideas. The important thing must become the ability of the people who you are leaving there to struggle through with their own. And if you're throwing out your own all the time, they're not going to have much of an opportunity to develop theirs. So you see, this can get pretty slippery and pretty tricky, but I simply want to try to bring some of these to your attention. Now, on this love-hate business, and I'm not going to give you a course on how to respond to propositions, because some of you aren't interested in such a course in the first place, and because you can't give it. But I should simply like to put a general kind of fabric around the whole thing in terms of the ideology that we are involved in now. I'm not simply talking about techniques and strategy at this point. I'm talking about the philosophy that sends us to where we are going.